at 217-333-6280 or visit CranertCenter.com.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal and Jason Croft at the controls this morning. Well, just a moment ago, you heard a story about the Congress and their struggles to come up with a budget. And this morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the federal budget and the size of the government. There is great concern, and has been for some time in Washington and elsewhere, that the United States government is running some very significant deficits, and there is concern about where things are going. Now, there are some people in Washington who make the argument that what's necessary is tax increases, that we have to come up with more revenue to be able to keep things going. However, we'll be talking with a guest this morning that takes a different kind of perspective, who makes the argument that, in fact, no, we really don't need tax increases. What we need is a smaller government. Our guest in this hour of the program is Chris Edwards. He is Director of Tax Policy Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. He is an expert on federal and state and local tax and budget issues. And we'll talk a little bit about some of his ideas and the kind of ideas that they have at Cato about approaching the federal government and its budget and what it should be doing and what it shouldn't be doing. And questions from people who are listening, of course, are welcome. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Before joining Cato in 2001, he was a senior economist on the Congressional Joint Economic Committee that was interested in tax, Social Security, and entrepreneurship issues. Before that, he was consultant and manager with PricewaterhouseCoopers, looking at financial issues being considered by Congress. Before that, he was an economist with the Tax Foundation. He's contributed articles on tax and budget policies to different publications, including the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, Washington Times. He has a master's degree in economics from George Mason University in Virginia. If you're interested, by the way, in the Cato Institute, and they have a lot of information on their website on different issues, you can go to www.cato, that's C-A-T-O, .org. And there is also a book that Chris Edwards has written that examines this subject we'll be talking about here this morning. It's titled Downsizing Federal Government, and it is published by the Cato Institute, and I'm sure you could get a copy from them. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Edwards, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And generally speaking, I don't know how much people know about the Cato Institute. It is an organization that has a libertarian perspective, and so we should not, I guess, be surprised that Cato would advocate for a smaller government as opposed to a larger government, and I imagine also would be advocating for lower taxes instead of higher taxes.
That's right. I mean, libertarian in a general sense means, less government involvement, both in our bedrooms and in the economy, and so we want we strongly favor civil liberties and are suspicious about federal government spying on us and that sort of stuff. But at the same time, we want less federal spending and lower taxes as well.
The Republicans like to point to their colleagues at the other side of the aisle and say that it's the Democrats that are the party of big government. But in fact, the federal government and federal spending has grown during the time that the current president, Mr. Bush, has been in office.
That's right. I mean, looking back now, I mean, President Clinton looks very much like a fiscal conservative in the sense of someone who, limited spending. It's true he had a Republican Congress at the time, and it seems that divided government, Democrat in the White House and Republican Congress, probably work the best to keep the government size limited. In recent years, under President Bush, we've seen the federal government expand over one-third. Federal spending's up something like 35%. In Bush's first 4 years, he's outspent every president since Lyndon Johnson. So the Republicans are certainly not the fiscally conservative party anymore.
How much of that has to do with either the war in Iraq or things that we can put under the general umbrella of the war on terrorism?
Only part of it. That's, of course, the excuse the White House often uses when talking about these gigantic budget deficits and all the spending. But, I mean, if you take a department like education that Ronald Reagan came to office saying we ought to completely eliminate the Federal Department of Education under this president, the Department of Education budget has more than doubled from about $30 billion or so to over $70 billion. In just 4 years. And again, this was a department that the Republicans used to argue ought to be abolished, but now we have a president who is nationalizing and centralizing education spending in this country more than any other president.
Well, what are we spending now? What is the bill now?
The federal government now spends about $2.6 trillion. But of course, it runs a gigantic deficit of probably about $400 billion this year. So taxes this year will be about $2.2 trillion and spending about $2.6 trillion.
Hmm. And what do you think that perhaps it could be or it should be? Do you have a number like that in your...
I propose in my new book, Downsizing the Federal Government, that you mentioned that the federal government, I provide a menu of cuts that we can shrink the federal government from about one-fifth of the economy or 20% of the economy down to about 15% of the economy. So, you know, for example, I argue that a lot of state and local activities, or traditionally state and local activities, like education spending, like highway spending, ought to be given back down to the states and the federal government, looking ahead with this gigantic health care, Medicare cost explosion coming down the road, simply can't afford to do those sorts of state and local activities anymore, and we ought to give them back to the states.
What about the level of taxation? Do you think that that is appropriate, or on the federal level, that is? Do you think that it's appropriate, or do you think that it should be even less than it is?
I think President Bush's tax cuts, you know, people seem to forget, but his biggest tax cut was the one he passed within months of coming to office, and it did seem like we had a gigantic surplus at the time. So I don't begrudge him for that tax cut. I think, you know, that was good tax policy, but I think he has been very irresponsible in not taking the second step, which is to balance the revenues with the spending. If a president or if the Republican Party want to be seen as the tax-cutting party, then they have the responsibility to show us where the spending cuts, you know, should take place. And we should have a generally balanced budget. That's the responsible thing to do.
Mm. There's a graph in here that I think is interesting, and it looks at government spending as a share of the economy. And it makes comparison over the last 100 years or so,
right,
from 1900 to 2005. And what I think is really one of the things that's interesting is if you look at the rate of growth, there is a dramatic increase between 1900 and 2005 in federal non-defense spending.
That's right.
And there is... also, actually between 1900 and 1950, there was an increase in defense spending. That's actually gone down some.
Right.
One of the things I think is interesting, though, is how little state and local spending as a share of the economy has increased over the last 100 years. It was in 1900, it was 5%. By 1950, it had only gone up to 6.6. And in 2005, it's only 11%.
That's right. I mean, one of the most dramatic changes in our democracy since the founding of the country is really this huge expansion in the size and scope of the federal government over just the last 60 years. For the first 150 years, I mean, the federal government was pretty small, and members of Congress in both parties, when they were considering new programs for the federal government to do, someone would rise in the House and Senate and say, well, look, that might be a nice thing to do, but constitutionally, the federal government doesn't really have the power to do that.
Hmm.
But since the 1930s, that sort of those constitutional limits have all been kind of pushed aside, and we have seen this very large increase in federal spending. I mean, one interesting thing is you mentioned that defense spending is actually down pretty sharply as a share of the economy, even since the mid 80s. And it is true that that's one of the reasons for President Clinton's success in controlling spending and getting the deficit down was that after the Cold War, defense spending was falling pretty rapidly in the early 90s.
There has been this very big increase in federal non-defense spending. And there, I'm sure, a big piece of that is Social Security, Medicare and Medicaid. And,
right.
And there is reason for great concern in all three of those areas that we, I think a lot of people are expecting that we will be spending even more, even if we don't do anything, that we'll be spending even more in the future. And there is concern with Social Security about the ability to pay future benefits, and just generally speaking, the concern about just how rapidly we should expect the cost of these programs to go up as a result of simple demographics.
That's right. I mean, in looking at the simple demographics, I have another chart in the book, actually, I show that by the year 2040, the number of working-age Americans who pay the payroll taxes to fund Social Security and Medicare will only rise about 14%. But the number of elderly people that the rest of us will be supporting will rise, will almost double to rise about 109%. So, you know, demographics is destiny, as some people say, and that there are going to be these massive costs in the future. Yet another graph I have in the book shows, you know, the impact of that. Today, as I mentioned, federal spending as a share of the economy is about 20%. If we sort of don't really make any reforms, if we have business as usual in Washington, the share of the economy taken up by the federal government will rise to 45%. That's, you know, that's European or Swedish levels of government. And so I think that, you know, there is a lot of serious questions here that Americans and American voters are going to have to come to grips with in coming years. Mm.
Well, we can talk specifically about some of the areas in which you make recommendations. And you do, you say that there are some programs that are wasteful. There are some that only benefit special interests. There are some that are actually bad for society. Some things that where the responsibility should be handed back to state and local governments. But let's save all that for a second, because
sure.
I think that there are some people who say that no matter what we do about those kinds of things, that we still are going to have these very significant obligations in the form of the three programs that we just talked a little bit about,
right.
Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. What do you propose to do to try to trim the increase in costs of those programs and also make sure that the needs can be met?
I'll tell you very specifically with Medicare and Medicaid what I think needs to be done. With Medicaid is the federal state program to provide health care to low income Americans. The cost is split about 50-50 between the federal and state governments. I think that the current system has led to a lot of overspending and waste, fraud, and abuse because the federal government, the states can expand the program continuously, and they have a political incentive to do that because the federal government picks up half of the bill. And that has led to a lot of waste. The New York Times did a fantastic series of stories a few months back talking about the waste in New York State's Medicaid. You're talking billions and billions of dollars. So what I propose there is that the federal government block grant the program. In other words, give a fixed amount of money to the 50 states based on whatever formula they want to use, and then say, you know, this is all we're going to give you, and we'll grow it by, say, inflation every year. But if you want to keep expanding the program, you know, it's your decision. The cost will be on your state and local taxpayers. For Medicare, which is health care program for those over 65, I think, you know, most of the people on Medicare are middle and upper income Americans, and I think it's getting increasingly unfair that taxes on young average working families are going to pay the health care bill for the elderly. The elderly who are poor get benefits through Medicaid. Medicare is for middle class and higher income Americans who I think should start paying a lot more of the bill for themselves. And so I argue that we ought to raise both the premiums and deductibles for Medicare pretty substantially.
Mm-hmm. And what about Social Security?
Social Security, I think it looks like, you know, reformers are now off for at least a while. But I think, you know, even aside from the whole issue of private accounts that President Bush argued about this year, I think a simple reform was proposed by Senator Bennett of Utah. He said, let's have what's called progressive price indexing. Every year, the benefits we pay out in Social Security increase by the amount that wages go up in the country. He said, why not lower the increases in the future for the middle and higher income people. Don't touch the benefits for low income Americans. Just cut and phase in cuts over the years for middle and higher income people, and that would substantially trim the cost of the programs. A lot of my recommended cuts, I have hundreds of billions of dollars of cuts in my book, don't affect low-income people at all. I don't suggest touching food stamps. I mainly target welfare for the middle class and welfare for corporations, welfare for higher-income people, and I think you can make a lot of progress in just those areas.
Wait, I have a caller here. We'll get right to in just a second. Just real quick, though, I'm interested. Did Cato take a position on the president's proposals to privatize Social Security?
Yeah, we're all for that. We're all for setting up private accounts and like trimming the traditional benefits while at the same time providing this other option for people to set up the personal accounts. So in the long run, people would get less of the traditional benefits and they'd have to rely more on the private accounts that were set up for them.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Chris Edwards. He's an economist at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. His area of interest is federal and state and local tax and budget issues. And he is the author of a book that is published by Cato that's titled Downsizing the Federal Government, that takes a look at the subject. They make the argument that what we really should do is limit the size of the government, make it smaller, certainly not increase taxes, and that's the way to deal with government spending and the deficits that we have run up here. And he has a lot of specific recommendations in here that you can take a look at. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. We have a caller in Urbana to talk with here, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Over the weekend, a bill to sell off public lands, I think mostly in the western states, was defeated by a rather diverse coalition. What do you or your Cato Institute, what is your opinion on the sale of public lands to reduce those controlled by the government?
I'm generally in favor of that. In general, I would argue that the federal government hasn't been a very good landlord in a lot of cases, not just for land, but in real estate generally. I think that there's a lot of excess real estate and assets that the federal government could get rid of. I mean, the Veterans Administration has apparently hundreds of extra buildings that they're just kind of hanging on to, and they should sell and put back in the private sector. The Department of Defense has hundreds and hundreds of facilities, old depots and bases and the like that they don't use very well anymore. Those sorts of things ought to be privatized as well. So I think we ought to go through the whole inventory of what the federal government owns and put a lot of it back in the private sector.
Congressman, I think it's Joe Morton of Texas, who's a powerful committee chairman, suggests returning pollution control to the 50 states. What's your opinion on that?
You know, I'm not an environmental expert, but it does strike me that there's a lot of environmental problems that clearly go over state lines. So,
okay. I just wanted to hear somebody else say that. I believe that myself. So,
You
had 50 different sets of standards for air pollution, water pollution,
right,
et cetera. And but this guy was interviewed on C-SPAN a while back, and it just amazes me that anyone would be so out of touch as to say that.
Clearly things like air pollution. I mean, I live in near D.C. here, when a three-state area, and clearly some things like air pollution are multi-state problems. I mean, the Chesapeake Bay here, but that divides Virginia and Maryland, clearly a multi-state problem with pollution in that body of water. So
yeah, and there's something called the Anacostia River that's heavily polluted in your area too.
Yeah, that's right, in the District of Columbia, right. I mean, but on the other hand, a lot of the things that the federal government has grabbed responsibility of, I think, should be state and local, and sort of in a bit of a different direction. The criminal law in this country has become increasingly federalized over the last couple decades, which I think is a big mistake. Criminal law is supposed to be a state and local activity. I think it's a good thing if states have different and unique and diverse criminal laws to match what people within those jurisdictions think. And I don't think the federal government ought to be making a lot of, routine sort of crimes federal. They ought to be left to the state governments.
Thank you.
Thanks. So just for the record, Mr. Edwards, you would not recommend eliminating the federal EPA?
No, I think that, I don't know. I'm not an environmental expert, but it does strike me that there are, federal, environmental concerns because there is a lot of cross-state border issues. Hmm.
Just for a second here, and again, we'll get back to other callers. I promise I won't make them too late, but to wait too much. But let me just have you talk for a moment about one of these categories of changes that you would suggest. And since we're on the subject of the relationship between the states and the federal government, about programs that you would suggest, things now that are federal government responsibilities or things the federal government takes responsibility for,
right,
and you would say, well, let's give this back to the states. I know, for example, one was highway
issues. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, in my view, I mean, just looking at the federal government spends about $40 billion a year on highways, I don't see any economic or technological reason why highway spending should be a federal responsibility. I think what happens is that you get, states that are growing very quickly, like let's say Nevada and Florida, they don't get enough highway money, whereas states like Pennsylvania and others in the Northeast that are growing slowly, they get too much highway money if they have powerful congressmen. I mean, recently we've seen this Senator Stevens of Alaska earmarking a couple $100 million to build very low-value bridges up in Alaska just because he's a powerful senator. So I think by federalizing things like highway spending, you end up generating a lot of waste. Local people in their states, it seems to me, people in Virginia have the best idea about how congested the roads are and how they want to solve that problem. Similarly, people in Illinois, North Dakota, the people on the local scene can decide themselves best what infrastructure they need and how much they want to pay for it. I think another example of this is the levee system in New Orleans. Because that levee system was owned by the federal government, it seems to me that, most people in Washington never even knew about this problem with that system before the disaster happened this fall down in New Orleans. And it seems to me if the levee system had been state-owned and operated, then it would have been local Louisiana, people and taxpayers could decide themselves how big a levee system they wanted. I don't think you solve problems by pushing them off to Washington.
Some people, I imagine, would argue that, well, let's take the interstate highway system. The argument at one time was made that it was in the interest of the entire country to have this system, so that's why it is we have federal involvement in having those roads built in the first place. Can you see any kind of argument like that that says there is some sort of common interest, and rather than having 50 states each doing their own things with roads, that it's in our interest to have this this well-developed interstate highway system?
I just don't see that with highways. It strikes me that it's true that it's in the national interest, but it's also within each state's interest to have a good and well-functioning highway system. Why? Because they want commerce, they want business to move to their state, and of course people want safe and low-cost roads to drive on. So I don't think there's sort of a market failure in the sense that, states have their own incentive to build their highway systems, and obviously states that bordered on other states could coordinate individually with other states, about the highway systems that go across the state line. I don't see these days with any real reason anymore to have this federal highway spending. I mean, it has resulted in the past in crazy sort of top-down regulations. Like between the 70s and I think 1995, we had a national highway speed limit of 55 miles an hour that the federal government imposed on the states with the threat of withdrawing their highway grant money. Well, it doesn't make sense to me to have the same highway speed limit in Montana, wide open spaces, as the District of Columbia or New York City, and yet that was the policy, pushed from Washington onto the states for a couple of decades. And I don't think those sort of top-down controls make much sense.
Well, let's talk with some other people who are listening. We have a couple of Champagne callers. Next is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Is there much of an opinion on about taxation of the Internet? I mean, there are some retailers out there that are, you know, taking a strain from loss of products that they're not able to sell in their brick-and-mortar stores, and the Internet doesn't seem to be taxed hardly at all. And also, I wanted to get an opinion on maybe bringing back some regulations on some utilities because of this energy strain that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Internet, there's two issues with Internet taxation. And one is the idea of imposing access, special access taxes on Internet providers. And the other one, I think the caller was referring to, was the issue of forcing Internet retailers to collect sales taxes for all their customers, no matter what state they live in. And I'm against that. I think that, you know, there's not only the 50 states in this country, but there's literally thousands of local jurisdictions in this country that each have their own sales tax levels. And I think it would just be too much of a burden to impose on vendors on this, you know, the on the Internet world to force them to collect all these taxes for distant customers. It seems to me that most, you know, certainly all the biggest Internet vendors these days also have bricks and mortar businesses, you know, whether it's Borders, Books, and all the others. And, you know, there's a place for both. And I don't really see that it's that much of a threat to the bricks and mortars to allow the Internet to go tax-free. I think both can survive and thrive side by side.
I can understand your point on that to a point, but, you know, for example, you know, you go into a jewelry store and there's a $5,000 diamond there or there's a $5,000 diamond on the Internet. That's quite a bit of taxes they don't have to pay. The jewelry store ends up taking the strain, and then eventually down the road, they're not able to compete. You're taking away a fair level playing field for them.
Well, you know, the competition is the funny thing. I mean, one argument why you don't want sort of federalized tax policy is that you do want states and local jurisdictions to compete on tax levels. I favor that. And, you know, we see the same issue, for example, even just, you know, states that have sales taxes and those that don't compete with each other for people who physically drive across borders. I mean, Delaware, near me here in Virginia, you know, they advertise heavily that they're a tax-free state, and they advertise in neighboring states that, you know, you ought to drive to Delaware and buy your goods and services because it's cheaper. You don't pay the sales tax. So that's been going on for many years. The Internet throws a bit of a new spin on it, but I mean, certainly ever since the Sears catalog, you know, came on the scene more than a century ago, we've had this issue, and, you know, and we haven't had a federal policy so far, and I don't think we need one.
Okay, well, thanks for your time.
All right, thank you for the call, and then we'll go on again to another Champagne person. This is line three.
Yes,
hello?
Thank you.
Yes.
I guess I'd like to put forward two main points and respond to that. First of all, I think you can tell a country's priorities by looking at their budget. And when you look at, you know, the budget of this country, it seems increasingly that we don't really care about children, we don't really care about poor people, but our main priority seems to be putting more and more wealth into fewer and fewer hands as people at the top of the economic ladder. And the other thing that I've always found about libertarian philosophy is there seems to be either a naivete or a conceit with respect to the power of capital and the power of concentrated wealth, and that is never, there's no accounting for that in libertarianism, and in fact, it only helps to increase the power of people who have the most wealth and ability to influence things and control what's going on. And, you know, there's no then way of the populace as a whole to put a check on that.
Yeah, I don't agree with that at all. I think it's a mythology, for example, that big corporations have a lot or the most power in Washington. And as evidence of that, the United States has one of the highest corporate tax rates in the world, at 35%. Other countries have radically cut their corporate tax rates. In this country, it's very difficult to cut the cut corporate taxes, and President Bush generally has not cut corporate taxes. Why? Because it's just not politically popular. How politicians win votes in this country is to appeal to the broad middle class. Similarly, if you look at individual income taxes, we have federal rates that run from a low 10% for low-income people up to a high of 35% for the wealthiest. It's a very progressive or graduated system. If the wealthy had such great power, they would have got that high tax rate down a lot more over the years. So I guess I don't, you know, I don't agree with the idea that there's this intense overboard sort of pressure by the rich folks and corporations to do their bidding. I think that there's a general problem of special interests in Washington, but it strikes me that many of those special interests fight for middle class entitlements, the farm subsidies, Medicare, and things like that. And I don't think sort of the rich get off scot-free at all in Washington.
Well, the tax rates are really an illusion. I mean, if you look at the percentage of the federal funding that comes from corporations, it has continuously dropped in this country. It's much less now than it was in the 1960s. And the burden has gone much more onto individual taxpayers than it was in the past. And income tax is just one tax. And focusing on that really, you know, doesn't look at the whole picture and how people really work with their money and protect it from taxes. There are a lot of wealthy people, and I'm talking now about the top 1% of, you know, people in this country or wealth in this country. You know, they have ways of protecting their money from being taxed, and maybe they have a 35% rate on some of their money, but a whole lot of their money isn't taxed at all, and other parts of it are only taxed at, say, 15%. And, I think that, you know, when you got people like the former chairman of Goldman Sachs, lifelong Republican, saying that we need to be raising taxes on the wealthier people in this country, I think that we ought to pay some attention. Thank you.
I mean, I would say two things about that. One is, in the current global economy, where we have these massive flows of investment over borders, you simply can't go around putting these heavy taxes on wealthy people or corporations anymore, because, as the caller pointed out, the money will disappear, and, you know, it disappears to the Cayman Islands or to low tax countries like Ireland. And that's one of the pressures that affects every country, every industrial country these days. And secondly, I got to say that, the who pays the corporate income tax is one of those long-running sort of battles and issues in fiscal policy that's very interesting to look at. Corporations, the federal government collects about $250 billion a year from corporations, but ultimately the burden of that goes on to either individual shareholders, to the workers in corporations, and to consumers in increased prices. More and more economists think that the burden increasingly falls on the workers. Actually, the corporations pay the tax, but the burden is pushed back down to lower wages on workers. But even if you assume that all the corporate tax burden falls on shareholders, you've got to ask, well, who are the shareholders today? More than 50% of households own shares either through mutual funds or pension plans. A lot of those big three auto workers, you know, they've got very generous pension plans invested in corporate equities. If you tax corporations more, it means a hit to the pensions of average, you know, working people in America who have pensions and 401k accounts. So I don't think it's an answer to just, you know, assume that there's sort of these big deep pockets here that we can easily tap.
We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus. We have several callers. Let me introduce again our guest, Chris Edwards. He's an economist at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. His area of expertise is federal and state and local tax and budget issues. We're talking here, started out talking at least about some of his ideas and his institute's ideas about reducing the size of federal government. It is published as a book that he's written by Cato. It's titled Downsizing the Federal Government, if you want to take a look at it. And Cato is also available on the web. You have internet access. You're interested in finding out about it and getting position papers and reports on other subjects. You can go to www.cato.org, and you can find out what they are all about. Just give me a quick, before we go on to some other callers here, we talked about some of the your major ideas for reducing the size of government. We talked a little bit about programs that could be devolved to the states. Just give me an example of a couple of we talked a little bit about special interest, I suppose. But give me an example of a program that actively damages society that you would suggest the federal government shouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, I give a number of examples in the book. For example, I think the federal government runs a number of programs that damage the environment. Environmentalists think, for example, that the $30 billion in farm subsidies that is paid out every year from the Treasury encourages farmers to overuse their land, to use excessive amounts of fertilizer and other sort of damaging things. There's a number of federal programs that provide export subsidies to companies that build environmentally damaging projects in less developed countries. Enron Corporation got hundreds of millions of dollars from the federal government to go and build environmentally damaging projects in India and elsewhere. It's that type of program that it strikes me that President Bush, you know, he could have really positioned himself as a populist if he sort of stood out and said, look, I'm going to cut these corporate giveaways that end up damaging the environment. I think the federal government does a lot of things that have been socially damaging to the country, and I discuss a little bit in the book about the policy in the mid-20th century for the federal government to steamroll a lot of inner-city neighborhoods and build these horrendous high-rise public housing projects. And we saw this in Washington and New York and Detroit and many other cities. I think it was a terribly damaging intervention by the federal government. It not only cost tens and hundreds of billions of dollars, it ended up having real long-term negative social consequences on the country. So those are some of the damaging things I think the government has done.
Well, we have a few callers here. We'll try to get them all in. Folks can help us by trying to be brief also. Let's go to Chicago for the next. This would be line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. By your accent, you seem to be Canadian. Are you an American citizen now?
I'm married to. I came down 15 years ago. I'm a permanent resident, married an American, and I haven't got my citizenship yet, no.
You have. See, and the reason why I'm asking this is that I feel everyone has a right to give their ideas, but the thing is, you don't have the same commitment that I have because I am an American citizen, and I have to live with the results. And I'm just wondering about the calculations you're making, because what you're calling a middle-class subsidy, like the farm subsidies, those primarily go to corporations. So I'm wondering in your calculations if you have looked at things that are actually corporate subsidies rather than middle-class and working-class subsidies, because farm subsidies overwhelmingly go to agribusiness, not to the small farmer
I mean, I've looked at the U.S. Department of Agriculture puts out the data. The farmers who receive the subsidies have higher than average incomes. They make more money on average than average Americans. And yet, you know, we tax average families.
Then why are you calling that a middle class or working class subsidy? Because you did.
And okay, I would say that's a higher class subsidy, but I would say that Medicare, for example, is very much a middle class subsidy. It doesn't. Medicare is again
it's
lower income people class use
subsidy
Medicaid.
Too.
It's a
working class subsidy. You know, we keep expanding this idea of middle class, but we more or less don't have a middle class. We just have working class, because Medicare is based on how long and how many hours you work. It's not based on your salary as much as the number of hours and the cumulative amount at the end. So many of these people on Medicare are actually were actually working class that put in very long, hard hours. And I guess I just feel very much you need to be very careful, because when you're talking about corporations, most corporations aren't paying taxes. As the other gentleman said, you know, Halliburton got a tax refund last year. So I just, please be careful, because you're...
You know, on corporations, as I described, you know, corporations don't really pay the tax. They're only, they collect it and send it to the government, but a lot of the, you know, where do they get the money? What they do is they lower their workers' wages, they pay out less dividends to pension funds, and they increase their prices to consumers. They don't actually, I mean, Halliburton, there's no big pool of money they have. They have to get the money from average people. And so I think that, you know, the corporate taxation is a bit of a myth.
Well, I've used up my number of questions, but I hope someone else asks you a bit more. Thank you.
All right. Well, I guess I don't really think of the Cato Institute as being a particular friend to the to big corporations or to big corporate America either.
Oh, absolutely not. We've you know, long argued that we ought to cut out corporate, well, so-called corporate welfare or corporate subsidies. I mean, there's many examples. In the book, I have a table of a Department of Agriculture program that gives out hundreds of millions of dollars every year to big food exporting companies like Chiquita Banana and Welch's Grapefruit and others to increase their sales in foreign markets. I don't think that's a proper role of the federal government. I think if Chiquita Banana sells more bananas abroad, they earn the profits, and so they ought to pay the cost. I mean, we give hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to a group called the Wine Institute to market their wines in foreign countries. I looked at the annual report of the Wine Institute, and their CEO makes hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in salary. So essentially, we're giving subsidies to this group, this special interest group, and it's going to the high salaries of their executives. I think that's crazy fiscal policy.
Well, let's talk with somebody here in Champaign County next, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Well, it's pretty clear that the last caller did catch you on calling the farm subsidies middle class largesse. And, you know, if you look at go to media transparency and look at what where Cato gets its money from, it's clear, you know, and we have this example of your colleague, Eric Somebody Bandow, who the Cato Institute website hasn't even treated the issue yet. I mean, it's the section
well,
called...
Well, can I just stop you there? Actually, the vast majority of our money, and you can look at our annual report on our website, comes from individuals. It's, I think it's about 85%. Most of the rest comes from foundations, but then we do get a small part from corporations. The reality.
Well, who sets up the foundations, and who are the individuals? And your
the
argument
corporations
about
many of the big, well-known foundations that you would have heard of. The thing is, corporations actually don't want to give us money because we constantly criticize them for taking business subsidies. So that's why we're mainly individually funded.
I don't buy it. And one thing that your analysis of where corporate taxes get paid is you did mention single shareholders earlier, but you know, why not from some of the profit of the corporations? The corporations are rolling in money right now. They have a problem of where to invest it, apparently. We've heard what a problem to have. So you know, the people that are giving to you are certainly vested in that sort of thing. So it is a class analysis that one should apply to this. This, I think, naivete is probably maybe some libertarians, but when you get to be in the Washington milieu, it can't be entirely naive. And the fact that this this fellow was taking money from Abramoff to publish, you know, pro-deregulation opinions is just a caricatured example of what generally happens in the foundations like Cato and Heritage and all of those, because they're buying the opinions they want to hear, and you know, it's an outrage.
Go ahead, Mr.
Evans. No one's ever told me what to write, and I don't take money from anyone. And when Cato found out about the incident that you discussed, one of the columnists here was taking payments from this Washington lobbyist. He was fired immediately. And so there's a high standard of ethics here. Unlike a lot of think tanks in town, we take hardly any money from corporations. And I guess I'd like to ask the caller if he's still there. I mean, I assume we agree then that, you know, on things like farm subsidies and subsidies to Enron, I mean, you would also favor cutting. It doesn't matter what you call them. You can call them corporate subsidies or middle class or upper class. But, you know, if you're against sort of subsidies of special interest, I'm with you.
Well, I don't favor a broad cut. I would say that we should target it to the people that are suffering out here in the hinterland, in the countryside, where the agricultural economy is already devastated and falling apart. And people are going to meth production as the major growth industry in rural America at this point. And it's, I think you're fiddling while Rome burns, personally. So I don't agree with an overall, I think it should be targeted. Obviously, the people that are growing cotton down in Texas, are going to apparently, if the Congress can pass what the negotiators in the WTO have authorized, they're going to take some hits. And, well, they should, because it's also a non-sustainable agriculture as well. Because
but you
irrigated.
See, the problem in Washington is that, politician after politician stands up and says, I'm for the family farmer. They've been saying that for decades. But then if you look at the actual accounts and you see most of the farm subsidy money goes to the big agribusinesses, as one of the past callers called it, that you see that this is the problem in Washington. You can have a high-minded ideal for a program like farm subsidies, helping the family farmer, but when the special interests get through, that's not where the money goes. And what I'm saying is this is a widespread and endemic thing in Washington, and I think the solution is to decentralize this power out of Washington. Because, again, high-minded ideals are almost always trumped by the special interest giveaways. And I don't see any solution other than to give the power back to the state and local governments. If Illinois wants to subsidize their farmers, that's up to them. But I don't think it should be a federal issue.
Just to mention that the Cato Institute does not have a statement about their firing of Van Dallas yet. So there's probably somebody else there.
All right, let's go and talk with somebody else. Indeed, next person is on a cell phone, and this should be, next we'll go to Champaign Urbana. That's line 3. Hello.
Hi. Do libertarians, et cetera, now hold many offices? What laws have they actually sponsored? It seems Proxmire also voted against a lot of big spending and spent very little, $100 or so, to get elected to the Senate, but he's managed to do so. What was he, a progressive Democrat?
Yeah, no, I agree with you entirely. I would love to see more Democrats like Proxmire. And there was, back in the 50s and 60s and even into the 70s and 80s, there was a fair amount of fiscally conservative-minded Democrats. And I think one of the problems today is that while the Republicans have done all this pork barrel spending, there hasn't been effective opposition to them because the Democratic Party itself, as I believe, moved more to the left on fiscal issues. So I would love to see more Proxmires in Congress to complain about the Republican waste, but we haven't seen much of that in recent years.
Hmm. What's the highest profile? This is sort of a side issue, but since the caller raised it, do you know, for example, what's the highest profile libertarian candidate that's been elected to office around the country?
Well, I mean, there is a member of Congress, Ron Paul from Texas, who ran as a libertarian in the past, but a few years ago, he changed, and he's been elected to the Republican Party from Texas in Congress for many years now. I mean, there's many people who are libertarian-minded in the Republican Party, the senator from Oklahoma, Tom Coburn, if you read his book that came out a couple years ago called Breach of Trust, it's very libertarian-minded in its orientation, and he's doing, I think, a very good thing. He was the chief senator who stood up and complained about his fellow party member Ted Stevens and his wasteful bridge to Alaska. So, I think some of the there are some true fiscal libertarians or conservatives in Congress, but unfortunately, most of them in both parties are mainly concerned about dishing out pork to their district. They're not, concerned about some of the rhetoric we used to, hear from the Republican leadership.
Mm. Well, given that given that Washington is the kind of place that it is, and the powerful members get what they want, and everybody else gets what they can, people are trying to get what they can for their districts, and of course one person's pork is another person's constituent service. But given that it is the place that it is, it would seem to me, with all respect, that the likelihood of the kind of downsizing program that you recommend in your book is pretty slim.
I agree with you that the short term chance of success for a lot of what I propose is slim. But you know, ultimately, as we discussed, that you know the entitlement costs, Medicare and Medicare, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security will be exploding in coming years. There's going to be more pressure on the budget than ever. And you know, the purpose of my book was really to educate, you know, average voters and citizens out there as to what is going on in Washington and where there can be savings in the federal budget. But ultimately, you know, it's going to be the American voters who decide how big they want their government. My purpose was to give them an alternative, a different one than they often hear from political leaders.
Mm. You think that it is, at least in the case of Medicare and Social Security, that what's going to happen in the future is that there's going to be more of, I don't know if means testing is quite exactly the word to use, but more of a sliding scale of that has to do with what people's income level is and,
yeah,
and what they get?
I definitely think, yeah, absolutely. I think both of those programs will be cut in the future. There's going to be no choice. I don't think Americans want to live in a country where the government's the size of the Swedish government, so there will be cuts. I mean, you know, we can argue about, and you know, lots of people say, well, there has to be tax increases too. I don't agree with that, but I think, you know, the entitlements, the path they're on is unsustainable, as many, many think tanks and pundits in Washington have pointed out for years, so there will be cuts.
Well, we're going to have to stop with the promise that in the future, I'm sure we'll get back to a lot of these issues with other guests who have different viewpoints. But for the moment, we'll leave it at that with the suggestion that if you're interested in reading on the subject, you can look for this book we've talked about, Downsizing the Federal Government, by our guest, Chris Edwards. It's published by the Cato Institute.
And there's actually a website, www.downsizinggovernment.com.
Okay, and I'm sure that they can also find out more if they go to www.cato.org.
That's right.
And they can find out about other stuff that the Cato Institute is interested in. Our guest, Chris Edwards, is an economist and director of the Tax Policy Studies at Cato. Mr. Edwards, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
The broadcast today made possible in part by a grant from the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM580. The broadcast also made possible by Eastern Rug Gallery, offering a wide selection of guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of every size and color combination, from new to antique, to complement any decor. Eastern Rug Gallery, 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign. That's it for us on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though. Up next, much more news, features, other things as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with Zainab Salbi. She is the author of the memoir Between Two Worlds, Escape from Tyranny, Growing Up in the Shadow of Saddam. She is also the founder and president of Women for Women International, an organization dedicated to providing women victims of war the resources to recover and become